Hello everyone, I'm Caroline Mayle, the co-founder of the Open Private School and the host for our Spotlight On podcast series. At the Open Private School, to put it quite simply, we provide opportunities for those who need them, connecting state school educated students with elite mentors in their chosen profession. Alongside the workshops we provide and the alumni network they enter upon graduation, we aim to be the difference when it comes to our brilliant students, believing they can achieve what we already know they can. We have launched a podcast series because we want to be able to provide the knowledge and confidence gained on our programme, but to everyone. We are here to have frank and informative conversations with exceptional individuals to hear how they have become a person of influence. There is no script, but we will be hearing about some of their highs and lows, the good times and the bad, and all of the lessons they have learned along the way. By sharing these stories, we hope to inspire our listeners to believe the truth that everyone should dare to dream. Thank you so much for tuning in, and we really hope you enjoy our podcast. Join us in hearing about the amazing story of Lord Michael Hastings. We discuss his experiences of school and the reasons he became a teacher after turning down an opportunity at the BBC. Hear his advice on the importance of giving back, why we shouldn't sit silently, and the power of the willingness to discover. Be prepared to be inspired by all the positive changes he has created in organisations and communities throughout his career. Thank you so much, Michael, for joining us and being one of our guests. We feel incredibly honoured for someone like you who's got so many different experiences that you can share and hopefully inspire our audience. As you know, our audience are young adults, so we normally start just by giving a bit of a flavour of your family life, where you went to school and things like that, just so that we can kind of connect with our audience from where they're at in their lives.
So I was born in the northwest of England in 1958, January the 29th. It was a terrible little town called Widnes. It still remains a very uninspiring and rather grey little town. But my father was a dental surgeon in Widnes. My father was born in Angola in West Africa. My mother was born in Jamaica. She had a Panamanian father. My father's parents were Indians. So the mix of ethnicities is huge. We ended up in Widnes, a very, very flat, uninspiring, dominantly one culture, white town in the north of England. And that's where I was born and went to school at a wonderful place called Tower College. And then in 1966, my parents decided that time to go to Jamaica and for my father to work there. And up sticks we did. And off we went on a cruise liner at the time. Couldn't fly. Cruise liner took us through, I think it was 3 weeks. We got to Jamaica, then went to school in Jamaica, the place called Cornwall College in Montego Bay. 1972, my parents decided to send my brother and I back to England to boarding school. We went to Scarisbrick Hall School in Lancashire, just near Southport. Fantastic place. Loved it dearly. Amazing 4 years. So those are my early years. Went to the United States for the first time. In 1968, we took a coach. They were called Greyhound coaches in those days. And you would go all the way up. We flew to Miami. Then we took the coach and went all the way up the East Coast of America, stopping in places in Florida. I remember we stopped in Atlanta. We stopped in Philadelphia. We stopped in Washington, D.C. We stopped in New York. We went up to Toronto. We went to Niagara Falls. Then all the way back down again. And the only drama of that trip, which I remember so very well, and I was 10 years of age, is that all of our luggage got sent in the wrong direction. So instead of going in the coach with us up the East Coast of America, our luggage went all the way to the West Coast of America, because guess who put it on the wrong coach? Me. And as a consequence, we spent 2 weeks with no underwear and no clothes. And we had to go to shops and buy things. It's hilarious. Absolutely hilarious. And I never admitted that I was the one who'd done that until my mother was well into her 70s. And I finally told her, you know, do you remember that time? It was me. She just laughed it off.
So there was just you and your brother?
Just me and my brother, yes. My brother now lives in the United States. He's a professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He's been in the science and maths and aerospace and aeronautics world all his life. That's his great driving passion. He's now an American. I remained here in the UK, was delighted to remain British as one of Her Majesty's subjects. And I didn't pursue an academic life. I did go to university. I, however, only managed to achieve a 2-2 degree, second class degree in theology, which both my parents said was a complete waste of time. And people were convinced that I was going to make nothing of myself because I didn't have any academic ability, which was semi-true. I didn't have great academic ability, but I was very adaptable. And I suppose in some ways, the story of my life has been, give me a challenge and I'll do it. And if you give me the detail, I'll find a way towards it. And if you think it's difficult, I'll make it easy.
You were saying that you love school. It was the best 4 years. What was it about school that you liked so much?
The atmosphere of the school was electric. We were sitting in 40 acres of grounds. There was a huge lake with swans on it. There were all the playing fields, which were beautifully kept. There were roses all the way around this great 18th century building. It was designed by Pugin, who designed the Palace of Westminster, designed Scarisbrick Hall. The Scarisbrick family historically had been one of the great families of England, but they never had any sons, so there was no inheritance to pass the buildings to. And finally, when the old Lord Scarisbrick died, it all then went into public availability. It was a teacher training college and then eventually became a boarding school. So I love the atmosphere of the place. The headmaster was a good friend, and I can say that even as a young child in my late teenage years, as in 15, 16, 17, 18, the head and I got on immensely well. He would read me philosophy and history and thought, and we would dialogue about the state of the world, and I learned how to care about big issues. And many of my teachers were, even to this very day, I remain in touch with the head of English at the time. He's now well retired, but I continue to have communication with him. He sends information on a regular basis to many of us who were pupils at the school at the time. So I just found it to be an atmosphere that allowed me to grow. And it was spiritually sensitive and mature. It was academically robust and challenging. It was sports-wise very availing, although we didn't play rugby because the head was convinced that rugby was a violent and vile game. So we never played that, but everything else we did, I remember lots of cross-country. But it's also a place in which you just make great friends and you learn how to think about the world from a remarkable place of, yes, on the one hand, privilege, on the other hand, disconnection. And I think there I grew up. I think I matured immensely at Scarisbrick Hall. So when I was offered the opportunity to become a member of Parliament in the House of Lords, I chose Scarisbrick as the place to be associated with.
I was thinking, that sounds very familiar. I've definitely seen that written in your title.
Yes, it is. That's right. Yes, Lord Hastings of Scarisbrick.
How important do you think your teachers were in helping you, making that decision for you to go to university and things like that?
I mean, teachers can be so immensely important, if and when, and mine did, if and when they look at you through the rounded lens of not exam-based academic achievement, but rather through the rounded lens of personality and pursuit, passions and interests, sense of well-being, and what do you see out there in the world you want to give yourself to. And I would say that the teachers in my school certainly really aided me, aided us, all the young women, all the young men, to see the world through the lens of we can step into it and we must, but from a place of principles and values and commitments. You know, don't make commitments you don't intend to keep, difficult as that is, hard, but try to, if you're going to set out priorities, live by them, choose how you want to affect the world, what's the legacy you want to leave behind. So at that school, at Scarisbrick Hall, when I was 16, I was asked the question by my very dear close friend, Michael, what are you going to do with your life? What do you want it to be about? Now, I know a lot of men, 16-year-olds, don't tend to ask those questions, but that's what was asked of me. And I do think we should ask those questions. But I was asked, what are you going to do with your life? And I gave this response. I want to speak for the poor, and I want to bend the power of the prosperous to the potential of the poor. And I felt that very, very deeply, to speak up for those who are poor, and to bend the power of the prosperous, that those with money, those with positions, those with decision-making authority, to bend that power to people who are poor and displaced and on the edge. And that's been my mission in life. So it was determined at 16 at Scarisbrick Hall School with an environment and atmosphere of incredible encouragement and wise well-being by great teachers, a great head teacher, and a really keen sense that the world is there to give to. You know, some people say you leave school to go conquer. Well, we were never taught to go conquer. We were taught to serve. And I think that's what I've grown to appreciate the most.
When I was looking at your roles on LinkedIn and you've got a Wikipedia page, I feel like you definitely have a sense your whole career of giving back, because there's so many things that you've done, especially on a voluntary basis.
Yes, I realized very early on, I'm going to use a Winston Churchill quote because I think it is the best one that says this so very, very wisely. Winston Churchill said, "We get a living from what we get, but we get a life from what we give." And I was taught that at school, that, yeah, you can earn, you can have positions. That's what you get. But what you give is what actually gives you life. And I also follow that principle, which is because of my personal faith. You know, it was absolutely true when Jesus Christ said, if you want to hold on to your life, you will lose it. But if you give your life away, you'll find life. And these things seem like contradictions. The Churchill point seems like a contradiction. The Jesus point seems like a contradiction, but I found that it's the reality. It's the best. It's the only way. You can store up an awful lot and end up with nothing, or you can give away everything you have, or at least the substance of who you are, to give it away. And what you have is immense fulfillment and great joy. So I was taught that at school. So grateful. Taught that, ironically, mainly by my dear mother. My father passed away when I was 16. He died as a result of a car crash in Jamaica. But my dear mother was a most amiable and constant giver. She was always concerned more about what could be passed on to our neighbors than what we could keep hoarded up in our fridge. So I learned so much from her. I learned so much from my teachers. And I was persistent and consistent in saying, let me follow that principle. Get a life by what you give.
How's, you know, being away from your family? Did you mind? Was that a challenge at all?
No, it wasn't. You know, it wasn't a challenge. To be really honest, Jamaica was at that point, 1972, in considerable economic and social and political turmoil. And it was actually for the good health, security and well-being of my brother and I that our parents took the decision to send us away to boarding school in England. I think both my brother and I realized we were being sent for our safety and our futures. And it was a decision I never regretted. Neither did my brother regret. Of course, you know, you have an emotional and a very necessary and a very loving emotional tie to your parents, especially when you're young. But they had both my mother and father had embedded into us that our orientation is towards the future. Don't spend your time looking back and wishing life could have been better. You had to leave behind that which wasn't great, go out there and provide a life that will be good, create a future that will be positive, create an opportunity, both for yourself and for those around you, that will allow you to flourish. So I think that mindset that they gave us, I mean, both my parents loved to travel. My father traveled from West Africa into Europe and across into the Caribbean, into America and all over the place in a period of time when people didn't largely travel. So he was a constant goer. And was very keen that we should have a sense of go follow the streams towards the beauty of the world beyond you. I have to be honest and say, going back on occasions, probably every 2 years, was wonderful to see Mum. We would talk all the time on the phone. In those days, you wrote letters. What a wonderful thing. You wrote letters. You'd then wait 6 weeks by the time you posted it for a reply to come back. No such thing as emails. So there was a real anticipation about every aspect of that relationship. But I didn't miss being at home. No, not at all.
Got you. You've had an amazing school life. You were very lucky with the teachers that you had and the lessons that they taught you. But what would your advice be for people who are at school who maybe aren't feeling very inspired by their teachers and their subjects and are a bit of at a crossroads with where they're going to go next?
I would say that school is only part of the fabric of what has got to be the curtain of your future. If you think about the way a curtain hangs in a room, if you open it up, there is great light. If you close it over, there is greater darkness, depending on the thickness of the curtain. But it hangs in a corner most of the time. What is it there to do? It's a utility. But it's made up of different styles, materials, images. if we see school as part of the curtain of our life, what are the other parts of that? Well, the other parts of that are the things we read, the things we watch, the friends we hold, the communications we make, the choices we pursue. I know young men and women who actively choose to go to libraries and read stuff. Yes, 14, 15-year-olds who choose to do that from less privileged backgrounds, others who just play their days away. So we have all these other ways of putting our curtain together. The school is a bit, it's a big corner, but it's not the whole story. The other inputs to our life, the relationships we allow, the things we watch, the things we read, the places we go to, the experiences we pursue. I was talking to a young man literally last week who's just 20, who'd had a difficult, very difficult upbringing, as in no parent support, no parent present, ended up in criminality, spent time in prison, been out of prison now 3 years. So left prison when he was essentially 17. And in the coming days, he's taking an 8-day trip on his own to Rome. He's never been there before. Why is he going to Rome? It's a city of great historic interest. It has artifacts going back thousands of years that, and he wants to go and have a look. And of course, you could say to a young guy from Lewisham in South London, well, you know, you ought to basically find yourself an apprenticeship and just conduct your life in the quiet shadows of Southeast London, shut up and get on. But thankfully, he put aside enough money in the course of the last year to buy a cheap ticket, to get himself to Rome, to spend 8 days going and looking at catacombs and historical buildings and seeing places where the Roman Empire flourished and understanding a culture he's never appreciated before. That is to take hold of your own future, to create your own curtain. And I would say to the wonderful young men and women listening to this is, if school is dull, and it can be, or even if it's beyond dull, it's just a switch off, or it doesn't inspire, or it doesn't connect well. Well, you are a human being with the ability to create your own future. Take from school what you can. Look at the world beyond you. Your phone has 8.5 million times more data capacity than when NASA sent three men to the moon in 1969. The computers back then could barely cope with what was required of them. But now in your hand, you've got a tool that shows you every corner of the world. You can spend your time on trivia, or you can spend your time on traveling into discovery. So that's what I'd say to them. You have no excuse, but you have every potential. And if a young man who'd been incarcerated, never achieved exam success of any nature in his life, had a family who all disappeared, no one has ever passed a single significant recorded exam in any of his connected family, and he can choose to go discover. You can do the same.
Absolutely love that, and I completely agree, of course. After school, you went to university, you studied theology, and then am I right in thinking that you started as a teacher?
I did. Yes, I went to teach in a school that's now called Uxbridge College. It's attached to, backs onto Brunel University. It was a pretty run-down school, I have to say. I went there because there was an opportunity for a head of religious studies position. Now, here's the irony. I hadn't even finished teacher training, but this opportunity popped up and I saw it in the Times Education supplements. And I thought, oh, well, I'll put in a note. I'll send a letter to say I'm interested. I sent a letter to say I'm interested. So I didn't fill out an application form or anything like that. I didn't have a CV. I just wrote a letter to the school saying I'm interested. And I had a letter back from the school saying, come and have an interview. I thought, this is a bit strange. I'm not even qualified. However, never mind. I went on the day for the interview and there were five people being interviewed as a whole, two existing heads of department from other schools, two other senior teachers from other schools, and me who hadn't even qualified. And what's amazing, bizarre and surprising is I was offered the job. But I didn't want it. So I turned it down on the day because I'd actually had an offer to go and be a trainee producer for the BBC. It was a unique opportunity that they had created for just less than 20 trainee positions. Thousands of people had applied and gone for it. I had filled in these forms. I'd eventually got through and there was it. On the very day I had this interview for a school, I also had a letter offer from the BBC of a trainee producer position. And I had to wrestle with these two options that were in front of me. One seemed very lucrative, the other one seemed very dull. The school seemed rather dull, the BBC seemed very entertaining. And then I would have to say, well, you know, I sought God's wisdom and I sought to know what should I do. And I would clearly say that I felt very strongly that I need to sacrifice the BBC opportunity, let it go, and go and teach in a pretty rundown, what we would these days have called a failing school. We didn't have Ofsted in those days, but go and teach in a pretty failing school. And you know what? It was five of the most flourishing, life-giving, enjoying, amazing years of teaching, because I think I was able to bring a dynamism to a subject that many people considered to be just tedious. But something like religious studies, if you can teach it from a conviction of true faith, what I believe myself, my own living experience of Jesus Christ, my own conviction of the truths that are there in the Bible, the stories that are very life-giving and vibrant, and I wanted to teach those. And if you've got that energy, and it's in your voice, and it's in your demeanor, it's in what you show, it's in how you prepare, it's in the smile on your face, it's how you enter the day, how you enter the room, how you relate to the children. And, you know, it worked. It was amazing. I loved it. I only left teaching because I got hauled into government service. That's another story.
I was going to ask that. I was going to ask, how did you move from being a teacher to then going into government service?
By a phone call. There had been the most terrible and distressing riots in 21 cities across the UK. These are the very famous Brixton riots, Deptford, Peckham, Hackney, Tottenham. Riots in Manchester, Moss Side, Handsworth, Birmingham, St. Paul's in Bristol, a string of places. And there was real, I mean, this was 1981, then 1985. There was genuine distress that particularly Black Caribbean, Black African, but at that point mainly Caribbean communities were feeling. Unemployment was soaringly high for them. Access to work was really difficult. Racial discrimination had become part of the day-to-day. I mean, have to be blunt and say there was police brutality. There was a real sense of fear. These people had come here. The Windrush generation had come to England to work, and they'd come to serve the country. And this was the motherland. And they found instead that they were discriminated against, picked on, wounded, often in some cases, sadly killed. For so many of those people, they'd had enough. And this was the time of Margaret Thatcher's government, and the economy was in the doldrums. It was in the pits, in fact. So unemployment was soaring, and they rioted. And I had a phone call in 1986 from one of Margaret Thatcher's advisory team. She told this dear man, a very old friend, who was then working for Margaret Thatcher in Number 10, rang me up to say the Prime Minister wanted to see me. They needed somebody Black, who could help the government at the time to make necessary connections between the resources that could begin to solve the unemployment problems, the apprenticeships, the trainings, the skillings, the education, the literacy, all those things that were necessary. But the distrust was so deep. And this advisor, he and I had met 6 years earlier. 6 years earlier. I suppose he maintained a memory of me, which was kind, and rang me up to say the government is recognizing that it's highly likely, having had riots in 1981, riots in 1985, we're going to have them again in 1986, and we really need someone to step into the breach. Come and stand in the gap. And would you do it? And it means literally working for a minister in the government, getting around the country, helping to bring positive engagement between the government, the local communities, and also the faith networks, because that was part of the principle of what I shared in those meetings in Number 10 was, listen, there's a network of confidence that Black people trust, which is the faith networks. Trust them to be the conduit for achieving this connection. And if you do, we can break the back of the pain and disorder and distress of high levels of distrust and the unemployment that goes with it. So that was a task I took on, took another 5 to 6 years. I absolutely loved it. It was haring around the country in a car with all these 21 cities. It was bringing civil servants, white civil servants, Black leaderships together, helping resourcing to emerge, projects to begin, employment schemes to get underway, some of which I still see physically in some of the inner city areas I go to. I see the products of what we did way back in the mid-1980s, and I'm proud of it. And between that time, 1986 to 2011, there had been no riots. And I think that was a good long gap in which we helped to re-establish a sense of dignity for communities that felt they'd been displaced.
Wow. What were some of the examples that you still see in some of the cities that you did?
Well, if you go to Peckham in southeast London, which is becoming increasingly gentrified, opposite the bus station, there is a small blue building which has got the words PECAN, P-E-C-A-N, on the front, which stands for Peckham Evangelical Churches Action Network. I helped to create that in 1986. That was one of our first. And that was a conduit organization which received a certain amount of government funding. And that organization existed to help to create these employment training initiatives, which were going to get skilling and development in place so that men and women could find work, to give confidence to find work. It's still there now. It still operates, and there it is. I mean, Peckham has moved on vastly. As I say, it's being gentrified. It's a much more mixed community now. Many, many different races and nations together. But at one point, it was very black, very mixed now. It's got new housing, lots of wonderful new local authority housing. It's got a more vibrant economy now. But there are still people with genuine development training needs. PECAN continues to provide that. I'm proud of that. And I think, wow, that's amazing. That's actually wonderful. Because what we were trying to do, what I was trying to do, what the people I worked with at Number 10 and the employment department were trying to do, was we just wanted to build confidence. Confidence in local community leaders and confidence with civil servants and government departments that actually they can work together to achieve better outcomes. The fear of so many of the communities where the riots had happened was that they were left alone. They were left out, left alone, discarded and disrespected. And then along come I, a young black man, with a mantle from Number 10, and people sit up and go, oh, well, if you've come from them and you're like one of us, then we'll take this on trust. And that trust was foundationally significant.
Yeah. Wow. I'm going to ask a question about creating change. But before we touch on that, there is another position that I want to discuss with you, which is you becoming peer of the House of Lords.
Mm-hmm.
And for our listeners, would you just give a brief explanation of what that role entails and what you do and how you became a peer?
Well, the wonderful thing about unwritten constitution and our political and leadership structure in the United Kingdom is it has relied over hundreds of years on confidence and trust in the monarchy and the diligence and leadership of the monarch and the government that the monarch appoints, the Queen's government, and the system of truths and principles and values which we see embodied in the Queen or in the Crown. And one of those principles is that the best interests of the country are in some ways equally divided between those who need representative government, so they will vote for their elected members who make up the House of Commons, but also some aspects of our governmental structure and our governance are also about upholding the constitutional virtues of the United Kingdom. And those are represented in the House of Lords. And the House of Lords and the House of Commons work together, but independently. So the elected members, for them, it is a job. They are there to represent their constituents, on average around 70 to 80,000 constituents per area. They have a job to support those constituents with housing needs, community realities, positions, making sure good local governance happens, but also to take a leading part in legislation, legislation for health reasons, legislation for education reasons, legislation for economy, everything. In the House of Lords, we don't have constituents. We're not voted in. We're appointed. We're appointed by the Queen. The Queen makes the decision, or the monarch makes the decision, as to who fulfills the seats of the House of Lords. It's a piece of historical reality. It's not democratic, but it's constitutionally what it is. It's like the Supreme Court is not democratic, but it's constitutionally what it is. The Church of England is not democratic, but it's constitutionally what it is. So there we are in honor of the Crown, appointed by the Crown to support the members of the House of Commons. We both, in the Lords and the Commons, take legislation. 80% of legislation on average begins with MPs in the Commons. 20% begins with us in the Lords. We question ministers. We hold government to account. Every department of government has a member of the House of Lords as a minister. We can question and critique. We have committees which examine. We take evidence. We seek to improve effectiveness and good governance. We're always, always, always on this mantle of what is in the best interests of the United Kingdom, of the four countries of the United Kingdom. How do we serve the sovereign's best interest to serve her people in tandem with the elected house? So you have to kind of be in it to see it in full. We are volunteers. It's not a job, although we do receive expenses, but we're not paid as a job. And the role is to support the governance, good government of the people, to make sure that things are done with honour, integrity and good service. Do we all achieve that perfectly? Well, pretty well, pretty well, despite the defaults and downsides. This is a good system. It works for the public interest. It delivers for the public interest. It serves the needs of the electorate. It serves the needs of the constitution, and it serves the needs of a world beyond us. I'm proud of it, and it delivers. How did I get there? Good question. I was offered by different political parties. I was offered positions in the House of Lords, and I turned down two, twice. Usually, if you turn it down, that's it. But I did turn it down. It came back because both offers were political. I didn't want to be politically identified. I wasn't going to be Labour or Conservative or Liberal Democrat or Green or Scottish Nationalist or Irish, you know, whatever. I wanted to be able to offer the service of my thought and life independently. And the wonderful thing about the House of Lords is that there is an independent cohort of peers, of members, ironically, the strongest group, around about 200 members. So I'm part of that crossbencher, independent group of peers. We make our own judgments as to what we vote for. We make our own judgments as to what we speak about. We make our own judgments about when we attend, what we participate in. We're not under the whip control of the political system at all. And that gives great freedom. So after turning it down twice, ironically, it came back a third time via the Independent Appointments Commission. And I was delighted to respond when it was genuinely independent. And then a recommendation goes to Her Majesty the Queen. And then she issues a decree, and the decree makes an appointment.
Wow, great. Thank you. I feel like I've learned something too. We were saying that you've had many a role. You've worked in government. You've also worked on a voluntary basis in many organisations and charities. In your opinion, what role has given you the opportunity to create most change? And what are some of the barriers that you've come up against where you've learned the most?
I think two roles have allowed me that opportunity. I was happy to be asked in 1988, would I help to set up an organisation that was then called Crime Concern, that subsequently went on to now be called Catch-22, which is a alternative to imprisonment, crime prevention and community safety organisation. The Home Secretary at the time, whose name was Douglas Hurd, asked if I would, with a Conservative MP, help to set up this organisation because the then government, then and now, wanted to test out ideas for alternatives to imprisonment and creating a sense of community safety where there'd been a lot of risk, in particular in urban areas. I was proud to be able to do that. I didn't set it up as a charity and walk away from it after 3 years or 6 years or 9 years. I stayed with it for 21 years, then helped it become Catch-22. We merged Crime Concern with the Rayner Foundation. We had about 500 staff when we merged. We had 1,000 staff. We were serving tens of thousands of young people all over the south of England, the north of England, Wales. We weren't operating in Scotland. We were operating through England and Wales, and we were providing distractive alternatives to dangerous endeavours. We were providing community safety networks. We fueled Neighbourhood Watch. We fueled victim support. We were the origins of those two great organisations. We worked on legislation that would provide a different way of understanding probation services and how to support young people to stay out of incarceration. I mean, I was really, and I'm so thrilled that it thrives today. I remain vice president of Catch-22. And that's been a long journey now. I mean, that's been, you know, nearly 40 years of commitment and time. And I'm proud of it. I'm really proud of it. So that for me, life-changing. I see all the stories of individuals who benefited from Crime Concern's work, Catch-22's work. I'm heavily involved in prison support work myself. When I say work, I mean as a volunteer. I don't do any of this for money. All my 21 years as chairman of Crime Concern were completely voluntary, no money. And Vice President of Catch-22, voluntary, no money. I really believe in that life of giving time, giving yourself, giving resources of yourself away. I would say that was one of them. The other one was the most wonderful 13 years I greatly enjoyed at KPMG, a commercial audit, tax and business advisory network, one of the big four audit firms in the world. And to have had the opportunity to join a big commercial company like that all the way back in 2006, to join it and to stay with it for a solid 13 years and to grow through the system and to add a bulk of staff to our network and to be able to push the principles I really believed in, this duty to serve the community, this duty to be philanthropic and generous, this duty to challenge responsible environmental behavior, this duty to care about the most vulnerable beyond our borders in the wider world, this opportunity, this privilege, this responsibility to be good citizens. I got to do that as the global head of citizenship for KPMG worldwide. And that gave me a platform not just to speak, which I enjoyed hugely, but more important than that, to work on transformative, practical project engagements. The biggest one we did was on a tiny island called Pemba Island, just off the coast of Tanzania, just north of Zanzibar, working with a community of 10,000 very destitute, underprivileged, probably the single poorest community I'd experienced anywhere on the planet. And I'd been to 64 countries. And this was just the most amazingly rundown, poor, desperate, unsanitized, unelectrified, uneducated, unemployment. Awful, awful. And we spent 9 years and nearly $3 million turning it into a vibrant, thriving economy with its own banking system, with jobs, with employment, with healthcare, with maternal care, with education for girls, with toilets for girls, with strengthened education for boys, with sports resources, with prospects, with electrification that allowed refrigeration, with medicines, and finished that work in 2019. And it was such an honor to do it. And I think when I look back on the impact of those two roles between the voluntary and the paid, I'm thankful for both.
And what about your experiences of barriers, not being able to maybe do some of the things that you really wanted to do?
Well, barriers. Barriers are only put up by people who don't understand priorities. And I had 12 years working at the BBC, 13 years working at KPMG, years working in education. And I just found it fascinating that when you make proposals for what are stridently obvious things to be and to do, there are always people who will find reasons why you can't. You know, the world is full of naysayers, and all the naysayers who are interesting because they have good reasons to believe that you shouldn't are also people that you need to learn to stand aside from. If you're following and pursuing a public purpose, a clear purpose, and I was, to speak for the poor, to bend the power of the prosperous to the potential of the poor. So I remember when having made my first visit to this community in Pemba in West Africa, in East Africa, when I made my first visit to Pemba Island, when I saw how really, really, really destitute it was, how utterly poor and broken it was, how absolutely missing of all facilities it was, when I saw how bad it was, and I thought, goodness me, I need to get this multi-billion commercial organization, KPMG, to sit up to the duty of being a leading citizen and do something about this. And I so clearly remember the chairman of the board saying to me in a board meeting, but Michael, what is the business strategy for why we should be involved? And I said, there is no strategy document, but here is the reason, because we can. And I don't want to have a longer discussion about all the issues and challenges. I've laid them out to you. I've shown you the pictures. I've shown you the facts. We either get on and do it, or we debate this for the next decade. Let's just do it. And the board turned to me and they said, oh, all right then, go and do it. So I did. And I found that endorsement very powerful. You know, it's so easy when you're working with commercial organizations, big companies, businesses. Everybody wants a strategy document. Everybody wants a costed structure. Everybody wants everything spelt out in so many fine details that you basically go through strangulation before you begin. And I wasn't willing to do that. I just showed them images, pictures, the reality, and this is what we could do. Here's the options of could. I haven't costed them, but if we just commit to a round figure, which is an estimate on the back of an envelope, let's do it. And they did. And I thought, wow, And that's the credit to the chairman of KPMG, the chairmen then, who were willing to say, you know something, our private interests are all about profit and commercial gain, but our public interests are about making the world a stronger, better, more equal, equitable, honest, decent place.
So what have you learned from that experience? Because obviously you're a very good communicator. That's one of your amazing skills. Do you think that has a huge reason as to why you were able to change the chairman's mind in that position and maybe some other people may not?
I do think a lot has to do with confidence. I think it's important to have confidence about the priorities you believe are essential for a dignified life. I do think it's important to be willing to exemplify and stress and explain and underline those confidences with good reasons why things should be done and done differently. So yes, communication does matter profoundly. But the other thing is I've learned over the decades that with a few exceptions, of course, there'll always be a few exceptions, but with a few exceptions, most people at the pinnacles of business in commercial organizations are human beings with good hearts and clear minds, and they don't want the chaos, disorder, disease and dysfunction of a broken world to exist any longer than is necessary. They want to be part of the fabric of success for all. They genuinely care about people who are disabled and destitute and poor. They really care about those issues. But what they're looking for is practical ways to turn care into commission and to see things done. So I've learned that if you give people a practical way with confidence to be involved and to be transformative, you see them rise to their hearts and not to feel that commercial company is a big macro entity out there and all you got to do is just do your job. Yes, you got to do your job. I agree. Do your job without any dispute, but don't let go of what bugs you about the need to drive dignity for others beyond the job, beyond the business. Do it because it matters that you have a stance of respectability and significance for those that the business can aid. That's the vision I took to KPMG. They were gracious enough to allow me to fulfill it. I've been able to spread that sense of enthusiasm and engagement amongst thousands of companies. I continue to do it in my retirement years. I'm proud of what we achieved. The record stands for itself. If you price everything to the minute, to the pip, to the penny, okay, that looks good on paper, but if you don't put your heart into it, it's not life.
They might not have the opportunity to be speaking to the chairman when they first start work, but what would your advice be to them who are wanting to influence others positively, obviously?
Yes, I was privileged to be able to speak to the chairman and the board of the company. I was honoured to be brought into KPMG at a very, very, very senior level, and I loved it, and I honour KPMG for both allowing me but also putting up with me for those 13 years. But what I would say to people who come in at a beginner level is you are an asset to the business. And the business is constantly looking to see how to grow and strengthen that asset. And so what you ought to do, if you feel deeply about a community or about a cause, about an issue, find common ground. Find others who share that equal passion. Find common purpose. It doesn't take the whole business to be involved, but it may take 10 of you, 5 of you, to be vibrant enough to lift up a cause with the credibility of the jobs you do. I say to people endlessly, please don't get on your high horse about a cause in a company when you're failing in your job. Do your job and do it to the very best. Honor your contract. But on the edges, on the side, and in the middle of the heart, pick up these causes. Raise them with people in the human resources department. Raise them in the corporate responsibility group. Raise chance open conversation or chief executives open conversations with employees. Send notes to executives and bosses about the things you care about. Don't sit there silently, grumbling away. 5 of you sign a note together to the chief executive. See what happens. Take risks. Step out. You know, I have so many wonderful examples of where people have chosen to grab the future from a low position and found that the chief executive, the boss, the chairman, the head of this, the head of that, has been looking for someone at long last to say it, and you've said it. So go for it. Don't hide in the shadows. But you only, and I want to underline this 1,000 times, only go for causes beyond yourself when you're sure that you're doing the job you're paid to do. Don't default on the job. Do the job to 120% of the max, but pick up the causes that matter. Find allies. Build common purpose, think intelligently, take the things you passionately believe in to the powers that can make a difference.
And I suppose you could also apply that to outside of work as well, despite the paid part. But you can make so much difference outside of your work too, can't you?
You can. You really can. You can change any community where you live, any community at all. When I was a teacher in, as I said, a pretty rundown, pretty basic, what would have these days been a failing school, one of the things that got to me within the first few weeks of being there, the rubbish, the crisp packets, the cans, the bottles, the dropped sweet wrappers, the rubbish that was in the hedges, that was along the pathways, I couldn't stand it. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to go and talk to the caretakers, the groundsmen. They literally laughed at me saying, come on, you know, this place is just infested with careless kids. Just drop everything. They don't even use the bins that are there. And we just can't cope with all of it every day. So you know what I did? I went to see the head and I said to him, well, look, the caretakers aren't going to pick up this mantle. I'm willing to do it. So I got myself, with my own money, I went out to Homebase, got myself a couple of those grabby sticks that you can walk along to pick up rubbish with. And I went into the school an hour early every single day and I cleaned up the site, cleaned it up, filled up bags of rubbish. Do you know what was amazing? After a couple of months of doing this, in fact, it was a couple of weeks of doing this, kids used to see me going around with a grabbing stick and picking up the rubbish. And they think, why is a teacher doing that? So some of them came and joined me cleaning up the site. And then it became a sort of, let's get new bins. So we got new bins. Then the kids started putting all the rubbish in the bins. And then they stopped graffitiing on the walls and they stopped breaking the toilet seats. And the place was transformed because instead of saying, oh, it's somebody's job to do this and they're not doing their job, my approach was, well, it's my responsibility to do this. So that's giving. Just always look for how you can give yourself away. There's always a way. Just give yourself away.
Yeah, that's such a nice example of you showing the students and then them following in your footsteps,
yep,
rather than just ignoring the issue.
Exactly.
We are coming to the end of the interview, and I wondered, is there anything we haven't touched on about your own experiences that you would like to share with our audience, especially young adults?
The one thing I would really most want to share with young adults is to say to them quite genuinely, the world is a multidimensional place. And what technology allows us to do is to go from the static of where we are into another dimension by looking into the screens of our phones, iPads, laptops, whatever it happens to be. And we go into, even on our smart TVs, we go to another dimension. We see another world through that lens. But there are other worlds also that we don't see. There's the world of our own emotions and our feelings, which means there's the world of other people's emotions and feelings. And as we want to protect ours, we need to protect theirs. There's also the world of our mind and our spiritual health, the things we choose to believe, the people we believe in, the God we choose to believe in, to worship, to follow. That life is so multidimensional. And, you know, we walk around as human beings, as boys, as girls, as men, as women. We walk around as though this is all there is. And we all know very well that we all have layers of emotion within us and thoughts, feelings. We all have perspectives. We're longing to understand the unfairnesses we see. We're longing sometimes if we look beyond our own borders. Why is it here we are in the, you know, 2020s and there are still people who can't even get a loaf of bread in a single day, who are desperate, who are refugees, who are running from terror? Why is it the world is so unfair and unkind? So when we have that maturity of mind, that willingness to discover, that keenness to look, then we grow a spirit of willing engagement. And I'd say to every young woman and man listening to this, step out of your comfort, step out of your one dimension, step into the multi dimensions of who you are as a human being. Discover the things you want to care about, you should care about, you need to care about. Be rich on information. Choose to learn and to discover. Only when you learn and discover do you know what to care about. So be rich on the information. Seek wisely to grip the community you live in, the world you live in, and then build effective, positive, good neighborliness. If we love the people near us, literally our neighbors, physically our neighbors, whether we're living in a block or we're living in housing, if we love the people near us, we create safe communities. Those safe communities are safe places for children, for young people, for women to be able to thrive within, for boys to thrive within. instead of places of risk. The more connected we are, the closer the relationships we have, the safer our lives are. And one of the tragedies of how our urban life has emerged, our cities have emerged, people are so disconnected from others that they then treat them as somebody to attack rather than somebody to embrace. So I long for this a reawakening of genuine community spirit. It's not an easy thing when people live in blocks or people live in less advantaged areas or less advantaged schools and facilities. It's not an easy thing. But again, the thousands and thousands of young women and men who live in complex, tough communities who achieve great outcomes. Let me give you one example. Going to, in fact, the second largest refugee camp in the very far reaches of the north of Kenya on the border with Somalia. Going into a huge living tent where eight people live in this one tented area. There are over 300,000 in the refugee camp. This eight people in this one tent, finding two of those refugees on laptops, studying accountancy with Cambridge University, using 4G technology to develop their skills in the middle of a refugee camp so that they can become people of significance. Now, if they can choose to do that, having had to run from terror in the north of Kenya in a refugee camp, nobody in the inner city in England has any excuses. It's all about whether we're willing to have the guts to be big enough to make choices about shaping our world in a way that is of value rather than just of gain. And that's what I'd say. That's how you make your life worthwhile.
That's amazing. Not that long ago, I remember you asking me, you said, do you speak to people? And what you meant was just, you know, any random person on the tube, would you turn and speak to them? Or if you saw someone crossing the street, would you speak to them? And I think that's also something that's lacking more and more, especially in young people, maybe because we're all virtual and we all have our phones, but actually just talking to people. We're not so good at communicating anymore.
Correct. And, you know, I ask all the young men and women who are listening to this, just look at people on buses, just look at people on trains, look at people on the London Underground, look at people on the tram systems. Just look at people. What are they doing? Headphones on, heads down, staring into a machine. And the machine doesn't love us. It doesn't treasure us. It doesn't feed us. It doesn't favor us. It isn't for us. But we've allowed ourselves to disconnect. Take the headphones off. Put the phone down. Look at other people. Smile. Provide light from one to the other. Help someone who's struggling with their bags, bags of shopping, bags of clothes, someone who's just struggling. They may not be disabled. They might be. They may not be old. They might be. They may just be pregnant. And it's a difficulty to get what they need off the bus, off the train. Help them take a step towards. And in that humanity, you know, we discover radiance. We discover beauty. We discover the reasons why the blood flows through our heart to the rest of our being. As our heart, which is really our mind, becomes aware of the humanity we're given to share, then we become whole. So put down the tech, pick up the hope and share it.
Thank you so much. We really, really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Caroline. It's been a joy with you. Hugely so. What a treat.
That brings us to the end of today's episode for the Spotlight On podcast series. Thank you so much for tuning in, and we really hope you enjoyed listening in to our conversation. Make sure you join us for our next episode, hearing from other inspirational individuals, or alternatively, you can subscribe to our channel. You can also follow us on LinkedIn, Twitter, and Instagram. Thanks again, and see you next time on the Spotlight On podcast.